From Washington to Pennsylvania, first there are the policies, and then there are the people. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, January 18th. Thanks for being with us today. The question of global trade powered a lot of election season conversation. President-elect Donald Trump has been critical of the country's major trade agreements, and he says his incoming Secretary of Commerce will have wide latitude to renegotiate them. The nominee for that spot is Wilbur Ross, a billionaire investor and former banker. He testified today before Congress, and he said he is by no means a protectionist.
I am not anti-trade. I am pro-trade, but I'm pro-sensible trade, not pro-trade that is to the disadvantage of the American worker and the American manufacturing community.
Ross quickly made his trade priorities clear.
NAFTA is logically the first thing for us to deal with. We ought to solidify relationships in the best way we can in our own territory before we go off to other jurisdictions.
The Mexican peso and the Canadian dollar both tanked on that news. Analysts said they didn't expect renegotiating NAFTA to be first on the list. Ross also spent quite a bit of time talking about and answering questions about tariffs. Now, speaking of negotiations, we've already gotten a pretty clear sense of how President-elect Trump deals with corporate America. He tweets about a company like Carrier, GM, or Ford moving jobs overseas. The company responds by promising to keep or add jobs here. And now some other companies are promising expansions and investments before the Trump tweet hammer falls. Companies like Bayer, Hyundai, Walmart. But at least some of these companies were already planning to expand in the U.S. before the election. Walmart is one example, and also GM. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has more on that.
Think what you may about Trump's tweets criticizing or applauding companies for their hiring plans. But Steve Odland, head of a think tank called the Committee for Economic Development, says employers should get used to Trump's style.
You know, it would be irrational to try to get the tiger to change his stripes, wouldn't it?
Odland says it's smarter for companies to try to change how they operate. He's a former CEO of Office Depot, among other companies. And he says while it is new to have the president-elect negotiate so publicly with corporate America on jobs, it's not new for government to put pressure on companies or for them to try to curry favor.
This kind of behavior goes on every day of the week in Washington. There are office buildings full of lobbyists here.
But the jobs companies are promising? Tim Bartik at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research says it's a few hundred here, a thousand there.
Even though these are important to the workers involved, obviously, it's small compared to the overall U.S. economy.
An economy that last month alone added 156,000 jobs. But companies are in a bit of a bind. If they don't show they're on board with Trump's job growth plans, they risk Twitter shaming and a hit to their stock prices. Dan Pearson at the Cato Institute says shareholders tend to take a short-term view of such events.
The day-to-day gyrations in stock values are troubling to people who own the stocks, at least the downward evaluations.
But Pearson says that companies announcing plans to manufacture here instead of Mexico, for example, where the business climate might be more advantageous, they might hurt their long-term profitability and shareholder satisfaction. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Also in today's Senate confirmation hearings, Trump's pick for administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt. On the question of whether global climate change exists, Pruitt unequivocally disagreed with Trump.
I do not believe that climate change is a hoax.
But as to what to do about it.
Science tells us that the climate is changing, and then human activity in some manner impacts that change. The ability to measure with precision the degree and extent of that impact and what to do about it are subject to continuing debate and dialogue, and well, it should be.
As it happens, in one of the Obama administration's last acts, the U.S. just contributed $500 million to a United Nations fund that will help developing countries deal with climate change. That brings the total contributed by this country to $1 billion, which sounds like a lot. But as we know, a little context can make things either bigger or smaller. Marketplace's Jed Kim reports.
The UN's Green Climate Fund was created in 2009. It was key to forming global climate agreements. Timmons Roberts teaches environmental studies at Brown University.
The only way that really the developing countries were kept at the negotiating table was with the promise of significant funding to help them green their economies and then also to help them cope with the impacts of climate change.
In 2014, President Obama pledged to give $3 billion to the fund over 4 years. $1 billion's a third of the way, but it could be the last contribution the U.S. makes. The election did not go according to Obama's plan.
And we will also cancel billions of dollars in climate change payments to the United Nations, and we will use that money to help rebuild America's infrastructure.
That's Donald Trump stumping in Cedar Rapids, Iowa last year. Heather Coleman is with Oxfam. She says the money's a start, but there'll need to be a lot more.
Recent estimates show that the needs are at least $50 billion a year for adaptation only for the years 2025 to 2030 for developing countries.
Joe Thwaites is with the World Resources Institute. He says though the new guard may not want to keep paying, there's a security interest in keeping at-risk nations stable. Also,
other countries will continue to move forward, but the U.S. won't be able to have its say on the agenda as much if they're not at the table.
And in terms of business, it could be better to keep discussions friendly. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the dollar recovered from yesterday's slide, but markets were mixed on, well, uncertainty. More details when we do the numbers. Yesterday on this program, we introduced you to Erie County, Pennsylvania, where last November voters went Republican for the first time since 1984. We are starting off a year-long reporting project based in Erie that we're going to call The Big Promise. We're looking at what happens in a place where the economy's changing, and those voters are counting on the promises President-elect Trump made during the campaign. Today, Kai Rizdahl visits Union City, Pennsylvania, population 3,300, in the rural outskirts of Erie County. Here's Kai.
In small towns like Union City, there is always a place where the locals gather. Here, it's Madonna's Restaurant, where the motto is enter a stranger, leave a friend. Tanette Diffenbacher moves between the tables, refilling coffee mugs and greeting her customers.
My little love muffin, how are you doing today?
Tanette owns this place with her sister, and like a lot of the people we've met, she has lived in Erie County all of her life.
Can I ask you how you're feeling about things?
Well, I'm hoping that, you know, they're going to think about the little people. You know, tax-wise, economy, I get some jobs in here, you know, stuff like that.
How do you think that's going to happen?
Well, I'm not real sure how that's going to happen. I'm not real sure. There's just so many things in this town that are now gone. You know, there used to be several big businesses in town.
Union City once called itself the chair capital of the world. Manufacturers and big ones, too, like Ethan Allen, made furniture here and boats and tools as well. But most of those companies have left, taking hundreds of jobs with them.
You know everybody in town? You must know everybody in town.
Well, more or less, yeah, just about. Good and bad. Yeah.
You got lots of folks coming in like those guys do in the mornings just to sit here and chit-chat?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's affectionately known as the Troyer Table.
8 o'clock every morning at the Troyer Table.
Good morning, everybody.
Yep. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
There's Norm Troyer.
I'm a local realtor at Dial Realty.
His brother, Merv.
I was a dairy farmer.
He owns all the land in the township.
He's
making all the money. You and your brother.
I just pay all the taxes, that's all.
Blaine Blakesley.
I've lived here my whole life, and I am a taxidermist.
There's William Mitchell.
I dabble in the oil and gas industry.
You dabble?
Yeah.
He dabbles.
I have a few wells.
And finally, Bob Glenn.
Fourth generation funeral director for 43 years, and I guess one-time moderator of this wild group here.
It's not hard to imagine that the guys at the Troyer Table are having some of the same conversations that are happening all over the country.
The election was revolt.
Absolutely.
Absolute revolt. The people are revolting.
How you feeling, though, about, we're about to set off in a new era, I guess you might say, in this country. I mean, it's an interesting time to try to be running a little township over here.
I feel there's hope.
Yeah. I'm not so sure about the guy they just recently elected. We'll wait and see.
That's why we have a difference of opinion at this table.
Tell me more about that.
Go ahead, Bob.
He can show his golden palace where he lives and talk about how rich he is and all this and that, but he's never made an effort to pay back the companies that he left bankrupt. That's where I kind of have my reservations, specifically because he's come out and said, well, we're going to keep jobs in this country. And if he's done things like this, I don't know how he's going to keep jobs in this country.
That's the promise he's made, though, right, gentlemen? I mean, that's, the promise he's made
correct.
Is we're going to bring them all back.
We're going to give him a chance.
Lesser of two evils.
He's our man now, and we're going to stand behind him.
He's going to run government like a business.
Exactly.
That's correct.
That's why I'm encouraged.
When our government starts handling the government like we handle businesses, and not like some pork barrel, we're on our way up.
So this is kind of a depressing question, but is it too late?
Not if there's hope.
No. No, I don't believe it's too late. There's always hope.
The coastal areas, they have their cozy little deals going on. But you don't make $30 an hour in our town, more like 10, 15, if you're lucky to have a job.
It's that economic disconnect, Norm Troyer says, that made Donald Trump popular in places like Union City.
This revolt that has taken place, and things are happening. You've seen Mr. Trump, even though he's not in office yet, make some very bold moves. He made one just today. Ford is not going to Mexico. Those are big things. You know he's going to get lambasted in the press about it. He's going to get beat up about, what are you doing? You're not in office yet. Boom, boom, boom. But, you know, he represents more of us, the common, ordinary person. We have to hitch our wagon to that hope that this revolution can bring something to us. I'm not talking about Republicans or Democrats. I'm talking about us, all of us.
Outside the restaurant, down on the other end of Main Street, there is one of those signs welcoming visitors to town, a sign that Brian Maynard says pretty much sums up what happened in Union City.
Down by the diner, right across the street from the diner, there used to be a chair.
A giant chair.
Yeah, it was the welcome chair for Union City because we were the chair capital of the world.
Brian used to work in some of the factories that made those chairs.
As things started to go downhill a little bit, then we replaced that with his boat because we also made boats there.
It's a big boat.
And then after they quit making boats there, then we put a little plaque there with a list of all the businesses in Union City.
Yeah.
And when the businesses started going under, then now we've just got a thing that says Welcome Union City.
Welcome, that's what I saw on the road there this morning.
Yep.
We take a walk around town, past a Family Dollar that's closing, past vacant buildings.
What's this Parker building, do you know?
And relics from better days.
Yeah, that used to be, I used to work there. That was Ethan Allen.
Oh, wow.
Now he works the night shift at a potato chip factory making $10 an hour. He runs the Union City Historical Society, too, and he DJs at the local radio station, classic rock, mostly.
So you're almost 60, right?
Yep.
You going to retire ever, or you're just going to keep on working?
Oh, we'll have to see how it goes. You know, I'd like to be able to retire sometime, but I'll probably have to hit the lottery to do that.
Brian's a Trump voter.
Fiercely proud of it.
Because he believes Trump is going to bring jobs back to Union City, which, it turns out, puts him at odds with some of his family.
Hey, there's my dad right there.
Is that your father?
That's my dad.
We got to go say hi. Mr. Maynard Kai Rizdahl, good to see you, sir. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
Oh, hi, Brian.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Huh?
You've been around for a while, Mr. Maynard.
Yes, sir.
How old are you?
85.
What do you make of the results of the election and how that went?
I'm a Republican, but I voted for Clinton because I looked at the people that were supporting Trump, that the language that they use, the gutter language they use on the streets today or in public or wherever, was exactly what Donald Trump was feeding. They went in lockstep with him because they called him one of my own.
Now, you know, you and your son disagree here.
Oh, yeah, no, sure we do. Yes, we do.
Yep. Respectfully.
So let me ask you something.
Yeah.
So here you have your son.
Yeah.
He's gotten laid off from one, maybe two jobs?
More than that.
He's working third shift at a potato chip factory.
Right.
So what do you say to him about the economy today and his odds of getting by? He's a 59-year-old man who's making 10 bucks an hour on the third shift.
Right. Well, that making 10 bucks an hour is a little better than he had, isn't it? Isn't it? Isn't that a little better than he had? Isn't that right?
Yeah. It's better than nothing.
Better than nothing. Yeah, but Brian Maynard wants more for himself and his hometown. He wants what he has been promised by President-elect Trump, things back to the way they used to be. Tomorrow, our series, The Big Promise, is live from Erie, Pennsylvania at the Brew Erie at Union Station. If you're in town, come on by.
Coming up.
I thought it would be really useful as a family to know what it actually feels like to have to pay for everything out of pocket, at least until you hit your deductible.
A doctor tries out a high deductible health care plan. But first, let's do the numbers. A mixed day on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average declined 22 points, 0.1%, finishing at 19,804. The NASDAQ, though, gained 16 points, 0.3%, to end at 55.55. The S&P 500 was up 3 points, 0.1%, to close at 22.71. Goldman Sachs is the latest bank to announce big fourth quarter results, beating estimates on both sales and profits. Citigroup, however, disappointed, coming up short of revenue forecasts. Goldman declined 0.6%. Citi sank 1.7%. Morgan Stanley shares rose 1.6%. Bank of America deposited 2.6%. J.P. Morgan Chase banked 0.4%. Target had somewhat of a less than jolly season. Sales declined 3% year over year, and Target shares discounted 5.7%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.42%. And you're listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Let's talk about global trade again for a moment, because not only is NAFTA suddenly up in the air, but just last week, Washington filed a trade suit against Chinese aluminum makers at the World Trade Organization, just when you thought those trade relations couldn't get any worse. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
This is the Obama White House's 16th trade fight with China at the WTO. It accuses Beijing of giving aluminum makers, quote, artificially cheap loans and energy and raw materials. Chinese smelters have helped create a world glut of aluminum, hurting all competitors, including American ones, says Morningstar analyst Andrew Lane.
The number of U.S. aluminum smelters has fallen from 14 in 2011 to just 5 in 2016, largely due to China's growing role as an exporter of aluminum.
It's not just about aluminum. Many see a broader resource nationalism in Beijing, where the regime rails against hostile foreign forces. Claire Reed at the law firm Arnold & Porter is a former U.S. trade negotiator.
This emerging nationalism is creating a kind of aggressive protectionist tone.
Sound familiar? The incoming president here says China cannot, quote, rape our country, and he's pledged tariffs of 45%. Wendy Cutler at the Asia Society Policy Institute fears trade spats could spiral well beyond the civil process of the WTO.
So we've agreed to these rules. Other countries have agreed to these rules. And if we break them, then we're sending the message everyone can break these rules. And I fear this will lead to a trade war. It's hurting our economy, hurting our exporters, hurting our workers.
By one estimate, a trade war could double our jobless rate to 9%. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Also testifying in his Senate confirmation hearing today, Congressman Tom Price, nominee for head of the Department of Health and Human Services. And that's a big one because Obamacare. Price didn't give a ton of details about what might replace the Affordable Care Act, but he did say this.
I think health savings accounts and high deductible catastrophic coverage are things that make a whole lot of sense for many individuals, and we ought not force anybody to do anything.
He's talking about plans where you pay most of your own medical bills up to a specific and usually very high amount, and then insurance kicks in. There are plenty in Washington who think these plans are a good replacement for ACA plans, but the people who actually study this kind of thing aren't sure whether they lead to good health care. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has more.
Dad's home. Dr. Ashish Jha's three kids rush the door as we walk in. Wrestling with his four-year-old was sweet tonic after his 11-day business trip. Hong Kong, Paris, Florence, stolen briefcase too. I'm here tonight to talk with Ashish about an unusual experiment he started about a year ago. He signed his family up into a high-deductible plan.
I thought it would be really useful as a family to know what it actually feels like to have to pay for everything out of pocket, at least until you hit your deductible.
Now, the family's on the hook for thousands of dollars in medical expenses until they hit their $6,000 cap. What kind of guy makes his family do that when he doesn't have to? The kind who's a doctor, a health policy professor at Harvard, the kind of guy who spent the last dozen years trying to make healthcare work.
And high deductible health plans are supposed to be one of those things that's supposed to make the healthcare system work better.
And none of us has the exact right answer for what American healthcare needs to look like.
What experts like Ashish have known for decades is high deductibles force us to cut back. The question is, what do we cut back on? Wasteful stuff like name brand drugs or the critical things like canceling a cardiologist appointment? And whose care do we cut back on? Ours or our kids? Ashish's wife, Deb Stump, says what they've learned is that they do a lot of guessing, like when their son needed a follow-up after surgery.
In the past, I would have just called and made the appointment. This time, I was pretty sure since I was a specialist, it was going to be quite expensive.
When it came to their son, taking a cautious approach beat out money.
I sat on it for a while, and then I called Ashish, and Ashish said, yeah, you should probably have the follow-up. So we went, and it was probably a two-minute visit and ended up costing $465.
The couple gambled, and they've realized this experiment, this new health plan, was affecting most of their healthcare decisions.
This experiment, it's stressful. It's difficult.
This is the new normal for Ashish and Deb and thousands of families. Families in high deductible plans. Now they have to shop for treatments, usually with no prices, no information on quality, and no way of knowing what treatment's worth it. So the question is, if Ashish Jha, a doctor and a health policy professor at Harvard, can't figure this out, what do the rest of us do?
What I take away from Ashish's story is that simply calling the patient a consumer doesn't make buying healthcare anything like buying cars and computers.
That's Harvard economist Amitabh Chandra. Chandra's research shows people in high deductible plans don't really shop around, even when they're given a state-of-the-art computer program to compare prices. What troubles Chandra even more is that the healthy and the sick skip out on the care that they need.
Prevention, imaging, drugs. Consumers were cutting back on all of those, and that's a sign that they don't really know what care is valuable and what care isn't valuable.
Chandra's work has helped solidify consensus. High deductibles are great for healthy people. They come with cheaper premiums, and most of us are healthy. But if you're chronically ill, poor, or unlucky enough to get hit by a bus, they can be a disaster. And it almost was for Ashish. The morning after he got back from that bruising business trip, his heart started pounding.
Imagine like running as fast as you can, and when you stop and your heart is racing, that continuing for minutes and minutes and minutes, it's not a great feeling.
Ashish has a condition where his heart can rev up. These episodes happen once or twice a year. They usually pass pretty quickly. This time, at half an hour, it was still going. At an hour, his wife wanted him to go to the ER.
And I was resisting it. She actually asked me, if a patient of yours called you with this, what would you recommend to them? And I said, oh yeah, that's easy. Go to the emergency department.
Ashish dug in. He didn't want to drop $2,000 or $3,000 or $5,000, even though he knew this could be a heart attack, even though he knew he could afford it. Did you make a mistake? Should you have gotten in that ambulance that morning?
Boy, that's a hard question to answer. I mean, you know, I should have gone to the hospital. But, you know, I knew there was a big bill waiting for me if I did. And I rolled the dice.
He got lucky. After an hour, his heart started to slow down. Ashish's experiment is helping him see what's backed up by research. High-deductible health plans can put people in difficult positions. In moments, they force you to be your own physician. That's something even a physician struggled to do for himself. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
And this final note before we go, I'm going to make a complete departure from politics and policy here. If you have ever traveled to Japan, you have probably been amazed by the fancy toilet seats. Yes, the toilets. Toto is the best known brand, but when Toto surveyed visitors to Japan in 2014, according to the Wall Street Journal, a quarter of them said they couldn't tell what the various buttons on the toilet panels were supposed to do. So the makers of these high-tech toilets say they will standardize the buttons to make things easier on the tourists. All right, we have got to go. Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer this program for us. I'm Molly Wood. Kai will be live from Erie, Pennsylvania tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.